My name's Ian Davis. I'm a researcher, a journalist, a writer, and an author. My background is in health and social care. I worked in health and social care, and I was a union steward for a number of years at various different jobs throughout my career. Unfortunately, I got made redundant again. I have to say, I've been made redundant a number of times during my working career. That's not unusual in the health and care sector. But this time I thought that I would focus more on my writing. I've always been a writer, and I started a blog which was originally called In This Together, and I started that, I think, if memory serves, about 2008 or something like that. But I didn't really focus on it, and then I've been focused on it a lot more since I got made redundant, which was in 2016, I think, or 2017. And I've been writing. I've been very fortunate that some of my writing has been picked up by some other outlets like Off Guardian and UK Column in particular, who picked up the article and published the article that we're going to discuss this evening about accelerationism. And yeah, so I'm that's what I've been doing for the last few years. And generally, I write about geopolitics and international relations and domestic politics and why and quite often about history as well. So those are the things that I focus on.
Okay, well, I mean, it's good that you're doing that, particularly because the mainstream press, the London press, does tend to focus down on individual stories and issues, but they never, hardly ever seem to look at the bigger picture. And it's like if you zoom out from all this stuff, you can start joining the dots. Your blog, In This Together, well, that's a bit naughty of you, Ian, because this is, I imagine, sarcasm. About we're all in this together, and it's lovely to speak to a fellow union enthusiast, because actually we're living in times at the moment, it seems to me, as if the wealth divide is becoming like a chasm. The rich are paying no tax. We had this incredible situation with Kwasi Kwarteng and Liz Truss, where they were saying even the super rich weren't going to have to pay any tax because actually they're not taxed on any of their wealth. The only tax that they're taxed on is their income as it comes in, and they were saying they even wanted to drop that rate back down to nothing virtually. So this in there, look, just looking from a sort of social justice perspective, we're not all in this together, are we?
No, not at all. And you're quite right. I did use the name ironically. I've changed the my blog is now called iandavis.com. So I've changed the title because people got fed up with all the hyphens in it, to be honest. So but yeah, no, I used it because I think when I first started the blog, it was at the time it was David Cameron that was saying we were all in this together following the financial crisis in 2007, 8, 9, 10. Obviously that wasn't the case at all. We're not all in this together. I think, in another sense, I did intend to use the term because I do feel that we, perhaps the working public of the UK and arguably of the world, are in this together. And I think too often we focus on political divisions that we might be better focusing on the guiding hands behind those political decisions rather than focusing on party political differences. And one of the things that has come to my attention, certainly, since I've been writing for other outlets and writing for people with often with different perspectives to my own, is that it's become increasingly apparent to me that the perhaps some of the traditional left-right divides are dwindling, I think, as more people come to realize that we are in fact facing, a unified globalist perhaps organization, which I often talk to about something called the Global Public-Private Partnership. And I think that there is a nexus between political and corporate power, which is more influential than many people appreciate. And I think, part of my work, and certainly something that I try to do, is to highlight that reality, because it is a reality. We can see it manifest everywhere. I mean, it's certainly through the last few years we've seen that very acutely with something I, what I would call the pseudo pandemic, And we've seen it even more acutely, I would suggest, I think this is relevant to what we're going to talk about today, that a lot of the machinations behind the scenes are driving forward policy agendas, which are set, I would argue, at the global governance level and at the global scale, are accelerating. And we often hear that term used.
Yeah, before we get into your accelerationism article, accelerating towards the dark enlightenment, can you just tell us something about your union days? Because I think anyone who's on the coalface of the world of the trade unions at the moment, you know, what we're seeing is actually for the past 50 years or so, we've not seen so much trade union activity. Just literally walking down the street now, you're likely to face a picket of either paramedics or teachers, possibly, or certainly nurses. Well, we've seen railway workers. I mean, our NHS rally here in Bristol was absolutely massive, sprawling out almost right into the road outside one of our main hospitals. And suddenly the unions are, you know, like literally for years they've been kind of out in the wilderness, are suddenly back on the streets again. So can you just tell us a bit about some of your work for the union and what you learned from that?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to mention my union by name because I'm going to criticise my union because I was with my union for 16 years and I saw it change. And I think the change came about, and I was, without identifying it, I worked in health and social care throughout that time. And I saw the leadership of the union become much more amenable to implementing management policies and implementing organisational policies on a wide scale. And you know, for example, one thing that I was particularly involved in with was consultations around redundancy. And I saw that consultation process become increasingly meaningless while I felt the leadership of my union at the time allowed that to happen. And when and I certainly felt for me there was a problem between what we with the local union office and the regional office, which often felt like a gatekeeper for management, to be frank. I've been, you know, quite pleased. And as I said, I mean, I left and I also left the union at the same time in about 2016. And so I have been quite pleased to see, you know, as you quite rightly say, unions kind of standing up and standing up for workers' rights, which is what unions are supposed to do. And I think there was a period, certainly during, you know, after Thatcher and then following up through successive Labour and Conservative Party policy changes, where we saw the unions take more of a kind of conciliatory, I mean, there's nothing wrong with conciliation, of course, but taking a far more amenable role, I felt, with the and certainly not defending workers' rights as I thought they should. So it is good to see unions now doing that a bit more. And I think one of the encouraging things that happened, particularly that happened during the COVID debacle, was that when pressed, I think personally, my view is that the government felt that the nurses and the doctors certainly would back down and accept the jabs. And I think when they realised that there were vast numbers of them that weren't going to, they were faced with a dilemma. And I think that's, you know, one of the most acute moments I can think of in recent history where the state has faced, you know, collective action and, you know, and unified action by workers, in this case, the nurses and, of course, the doctors, to stand up against the state and back down, because I think they realised that they couldn't just sack, you know, whatever the numbers were. I personally feel it was probably far more than 100,000, but, you know, we were given the sort of broad figure of 100,000. So recently now seeing the unions step up and, you know, certainly stand up more for pay in the face of inflation, which is caused by, I would argue, by monetary policy in particular.
Hang on a second. Hang on a second, because if we go back to NHS 100, the people who were stopping, saying that no, we are not going to have a jab and we're prepared to lose our job over it. Actually, the fact of the matter is, and it's great to hear you saying I've worked for a union, but I'm very critical of unions. I'm quite the same with my own union, and although I wouldn't be without them, they can be absolutely appalling sometimes. What the point I'm trying to make, though, is that the unions often to do with the mandates, the jab mandates. Our union, the NUJ, was very good on it. Some of the activists quite early on got a resolution passed at our annual conference saying no journalists will be mandatory jabs for journalists, which was quite good. But, some of the health unions, for example, were actually on the wrong side on that one.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think that's not unusual, especially in the frontline public health services in particular, and that was my experience, but at the moment obviously there's moves with the Tories at the moment that are trying to draw up legislation that will basically make it even harder for public sector workers to stand up for their rights.
Yeah, well, what they're saying is, let's just be specific here, is that there are going to be minimum standards of service for all public services, including railways, etc. So they're basically saying that they will, if people go on strike, they'll lose their jobs. Now, this is the sort of thing that you might have got in Franco's Spain.
Yeah, exactly the same sort of thing. I mean, and I would think that there are a lot more parallels with things that we might have seen in Franco's Spain that are happening at the moment as well. The way that society is heading towards a very sort of authoritarian and, I would argue increasingly, I think it is fair to say, a totalitarian model of society. But that's not just in the UK either, I would say. I mean, it's pretty much happening everywhere simultaneously, which points towards central coordination at a higher level than just national governments.
Yeah, well, anyway, so let's get on to your article about accelerationism, which I was really, really enjoyed reading, but particularly because it's not just a kind of opinion piece. There's a tremendous amount of referencing there. And, I sent you actually one or two other. I keep seeing this word used, for example, in what's his first name? Larry Fink, the boss of BlackRock, keeps coming out with this word. We're going to accelerate this. It all needs it to be accelerated. This word pops up all over the place if you realize what you're looking for. You talk about it at the United Nations, the World Economic Forum, at BlackRock, the World Health Organization, Vanguard. All these people seem to be using this. It's almost like it's a creed. So anyway, can you just take us through, what made you decide to take a look at this?
Well, I didn't know anything about it. I'd never heard. I was aware that the term kept coming up, and I was aware of all the different government accelerators, and I was aware that, for example, the World Economic Forum's strategic partnership with the United Nations is about accelerating sustainable development. But I hadn't made the connection. But then I wasn't aware that this, that this was that there was an underlying theory behind this. But then it was Mike Robinson at UK Column said, "Have you heard of this thing, accelerationism?" And I started looking into it. And I think perhaps one of the advantages I had when I came to write the article is that I didn't have any preconception even of what it was. I didn't know anything about it. And so, I had to come at it with a completely blank slate and research it from scratch. And that's that. What that I must admit, what that led me into was a quite bizarre world. When I started, certainly when I was looking at something called, we might go on to discuss, called the Dark Enlightenment. It was It was some pretty deep stuff and some pretty crazy stuff. But then when I, the more I looked at it, and then the more that I looked at, as you quite rightly say, as people like Fink and Schwab but more so, not just those, but you know, politicians, you know, in the UK, using this term all the time. Now, obviously, accelerate can just mean, you know, to quicken or to go faster. But the amount of times that it is referenced and the number of different accelerators that there are, you know, certainly I concluded with the more that I looked at it, that there is an underlying ideology behind this. And once you kind of grasp that, then as you say, when you start looking pretty much anywhere, really, it is everywhere. There is definitely, there's definitely a kind of cohesive ethos behind, and that's why it's so prevalent. That's why we see this term all the time, because it's actually referring to a specific strategy.
Okay, so what is accelerationism? If I was to get hold of the creed, the manifesto, this document called The Dark Enlightenment, written by Nick Land, who bizarrely I was at school with. When we were at school together, he was known as Nick the Nazi, and you might well ask me why. What were you doing being friends with Nick the Nazi? Just to let you know, it was at Langley Park School in Beckenham, right next door, bizarrely, right next door to the Wellcome Trust headquarters, where they did all their research in Beckenham in Kent. And so what is it? What is this creed?
Well, the first thing is, Nick Land wrote The Dark Enlightenment. But I would say that the accelerationism isn't just a right-wing. So Nick Land was very closely associated with Peter Thiel, and so they're his detractors, and they obviously, you know, Thiel's relationship with people like Steve Bannon and the Trump clan and so forth. So people have kind of leapt on the right wing, you could call it, the right wing version, which was encapsulated by in the Dark Enlightenment. And kind of criticised it. The left has very much criticised it from that perspective. Saying,
okay, well, look, before you go on, Ian, I also must add that Nick Land has also, I wouldn't use the word endorsed, but he approves of something called the Order of the Nine Angles as well, which is something which we've been looking into on the programme. It's basically a kind of a creed where, the idea is that you become a terrorist and that you are a little cell all on your own. Nobody else is implicated in any of the actions that you do. And it's fascinating to look at this attempt at far-right terrorism. The idea is to try and get... I mean, for example, there was actually a conviction of a US soldier who was part of these, or had picked up on this Order of the Nine Angles, who was trying to orchestrate a terrorist attack on his own US unit from an ISIS unit. I mean, they seem to be about crisis initiation, conflict initiation. The idea is to try and be the spark which sets off a wider conflict or even a war. Who knows? But this is another very, very much associated with the far right aspect of Nick's thinking.
Well, yeah, I mean, I wasn't aware of that. So, I mean, yeah, I mean, certainly the idea in the Dark Enlightenment, and this is something that runs throughout acceleration, no matter which perspective you look at it from, is that crisis perpetuates change. And therefore, the greater the magnitude of the crisis and the faster that you can run through the process of change, the better the outcome will be. Because the objective is to break down and break apart existing structures in order to replace them with, in the Dark Enlightenment, the idea is to replace it with some kind of corporate Uber state where, I thought it was pretty crazy stuff, I have to say, as I was reading it. But you have to say, you can see that happening. It's about destruction, and it's about, it's like, it's very much based upon what Schumpeter, in terms of economic, the kind of economic perspective, what Schumpeter spoke about in terms of creative destruction, about breaking apart existing systems in order to replace them. Now, from Land's perspective, the modern democratic, I would argue whether it is democratic, but that's another point. But the point is, the modern kind of liberal democracies are fundamentally morally corrupt. There's nothing good that can come out of these liberal democracies. Therefore, they need to be destroyed. And anything that hastens that destruction, then this is the point, I think, as well with accelerationism, whether you actually, it's very Machiavellian. It's whether or not you agree with the process, the ends justify the means. So anything that destroys the system, that leads to the breakdown from his perspective of liberal democracy, is a good thing, because that will hasten its demise and therefore allow the transition and transformation to a new type of society. The same is true. You see the same as well in terms of, we might talk about climate change, for example, which is the great demon that the left saw when they've adopted accelerationism. So it's the same thing. Whatever leads us towards sustainable development, all that matters is that we achieve sustainable development in order to tackle climate change. Nothing else matters, because that is your primary objective. So it's about creative destruction, but it's creative destruction of everything. It's not just creative destruction of our economy, creative destruction of society, of polity, of everything, because the aim is to create a better future. And I think the thing that is key to both perspectives of it is that the longer the current status quo continues, the worse the outcome will be. So the quicker it can be finished off, the better.
Crikey. Well, there's a couple of things there. First of all, liberal democracy is certainly flawed, but when it comes to an alternative being some kind of cyber dictatorship or anything else, it might actually be, the point is, I suppose, it's being undermined, it's being deliberately infiltrated, so sometimes it works. Say, for example, if you've got a security service that makes sure that elections are conducted fairly and honestly, if you've got a finance system for parties and for people running for office that makes sure that everybody that has got a decent number of votes gets the same amount of money to pay for their election, these things can function quite well. I don't know if you agree with that, but it seems to me they're saying that something's broken, but actually they're breaking it. The other thing I was going to mention was, back in 2020, I think it was, of course, when everything was kind of up in the air when it comes to the pandemic in Parliament, they passed this law which said that government agencies can break the law with impunity. So there's a couple of aspects, just teasing out from what you were just talking about. So it seems that, first of all, they're saying we're going to change things because it's not working, but it's them that's making it not work. And secondly, we're now in this environment where the government can apparently kill people, and it's above the law.
Yeah, and I think these things come together because, one of the points that I make in the article is, despite what the right kind of Nick Land Dark Enlightenment lobby, for want of a the problems that they perceive, and regardless of what the kind of left-leaning accelerationist manifesto part side of the argument, and people like Paul Mason and stuff and have written about the as you said, the kind of the cyber utopia that we might be, that they envisage. It doesn't really matter. What I concluded was it neither of those wings of acceleration are going to get what they want, because it has been adopted and co-opted by people, I would argue, again, at the kind of global governance level and at the national level, who have, like they do with nearly all kind of ideas. I mean, you can certainly, I mean, if we look at something like the new normal and communitarianism, the idea behind communitarianism is not to radically change, or to particularly to exclude people from the political process. It's the opposite. But that is not how people like, for example, the World Economic Forum adapt and adopt these ideas. So the idea gets taken up at I would argue, at a globalist level in this case, and is used for different ends. And that's very much what is happening at the moment with accelerationism. So, for example, from Land's perspective, Land saw the destruction. One of the things that he pointed out was the problem was what he called the cathedral. So the cathedral was the, I call it the the global public-private partnership, but the cathedral is this nexus between politics and global corporate state. And where we see multinational corporations quite clearly have massive influence over political policy. I mean, that seems evident to me. So Land called that the cathedral, and he said that that had to be eroded, that needed to be destroyed, because in order to get to a pure, what he saw as a pure state of total, complete and utter free market kind of corporatism, because he argued that it was almost, there are aspects of technocracy in it, in that he argued that the kind of corporate leaders knew best how to manage society, and that there was no need for politics. Politics just got in the way. That's how he envisaged it. But what we are seeing with, certainly with things like, for example, if we look at how the sustainable development is being applied to things like the energy transformation, the transformation of energy globally, is that nexus between the political wing of the decision-making process and the corporate kind of objective for increased control, they're working together. So actually, the cathedral as acceleration, but they're still using accelerationism. So they're using acceleration to break apart the existing kind of political systems and geopolitical kind of norms that we're accustomed to are being broken down, but not to the detriment of the cathedral, which is what Land envisaged. It is to the benefit of the cathedral. So that's the opposite of what Land was arguing for.
Well, that just, I mean, it reminds me of Nick when I knew him. He was full of contradictions like that. Now, you mentioned Peter Thiel. I mean, he's a very interesting chap, a Bilderberger. He one of the founders of PayPal, one of the funders of Facebook, one of the most powerful people in the world with his little bolt hole in New Zealand. I mean, the idea that he has taken this up as his kind of creed. There are others too as well. Yuval Noah Harari talks about this and certainly picks up on many of the ideas. It does seem to me that this is almost like a kind of secret religion amongst the rich and, I mean, really some of the most powerful people in the world. And in a way, if you've got someone like Yuval Noah Harari constantly churning out books about this kind of new vision of the world and everything's going to change. And then you've got all the people who are in position to make that change. It seems to me, there's something going on here. We're also this week, we've got the World Economic Forum meeting in Davos, apparently without very much snow, which maybe means that we should have organized a protest of some sort, because it's usually the cold and the snow that keeps the protesters away. And of course, that's why they do it there. What do you make of What do you make of, so first of all, Peter Thiel is one, but what do you make of this kind of, you know, lots of these elitists seem to be into this, and is it actually their kind of secret religion? And secondly, about the links to Davos, because obviously that's where they all are right now.
Yeah, I mean, I think personally, I mean, I think there are lots of kind of themes that we can see that are fairly evident in the behavior and the decisions and the kind of objectives of the global, I would call them the parasite class, but that are, you know, for example, eugenics. I mean, eugenics is prevalent in everything. I mean, eugenics is obvious in nearly everything about sustainable development. It is all about population control. And, you know, I mean, I think population control can mean many things. I'm not so sure that there is necessarily a massive agreement between everyone that they need to hugely depopulate the planet. But when you look at things like how we are possibly going to be able to run the planet on batteries, when there doesn't appear to be enough resources on Earth in order to build those batteries, it does suggest that there'll be fewer of us, or we'll all be living in, you know, some sort of dark age, because, you know, there isn't enough energy to go around if we're just going to use batteries. So that does suggest depopulation. And, you know, there are lots of other things that have happened that have suggested depopulation as well. Regard to accelerationism.
Well, just hang on a second, because I wonder, we've just had this week the announcement of the collapse of the UK electric car battery startup. So maybe there was a vision for this set out by Harari and various other people, but actually the proverbial is hitting the fan. And whilst this might be their vision, financially, it doesn't stack up. I mean, a lot of people would say that about the whole vision for electric cars. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, the irony is, I mean, you see, you know, this is happening in Europe and happening with Volk as well, is that the energy price, which is pretty crazy, the energy price is putting them out of business. So it's, you know, the rise spiraling cost of energy. The people that make renewable energy can't make enough renewable energy to power their renewable energy factories. And not, I mean, in the case of Volk, it was investment as well, wasn't it? That, you know, that they weren't getting the investment and they'd overextended themselves. But I mean, but nonetheless, that is happening all over Europe. So the energy, so we're in this crazy situation where we are being told, and this I would argue, this is classic accelerationism. So we have been told we must act now. There's no time to wait. We have to act now, which accelerationism constantly advocates. And the emergency situation, the constant crisis, the crisis as a catalyst for change. So we must act now, and must, hell or high water, we must have more renewable energy. Without really thinking about how that is going to work. Where are we going to get all the lithium? Where's the cobalt? Where are we going to get these rare earth metals and things like that we're going to need if we are seriously going to power the world using electricity, which is fundamentally what renewable energy boils down to? How is that going to work? Now, the point of accelerationism is, and this is where I think you may well be right about it being a ruse that is used, because it's acceleration itself which is the important aspect, is that it can't. It, at the moment, with the current state of technology and the current technological capability that we have, and as far as anyone knows about the availability of resources, it can't work. Not now. It may be able to work in the future with, you know, maybe if there's some sort of technological advance, but it can't work now. So therefore, by forcing and pushing and rushing and propelling governments around the world, supposedly, to adopt nothing but, you know, to ramp up. I mean, Germany, with its energy, Wendy, are talking about, and they recently had this Easter package of reforms, are talking about having 80% renewable energy by, I think, 2035. The country won't work. The country will come to a standstill. So that is, you know, you could argue that that is what Schumpeter, if we looked at it from economic terms, that is what creative destruction. That is the deliberate destruction, it would seem, of and unnecessary destruction of what would otherwise be and continue to be a relatively, you know, a thriving economy.
Well, so, I think this is really fascinating, looking at the idea that the stuff which is being churned out as the solution to the problem. I don't think anyone would argue that we've got a problem with pollution. We've got a, you know, we've got a warming planet. Quite whether that's to do with humans is another question. But we certainly got, you know, we've got much far too much dependency on Middle Eastern oil. You know, they're, for example, not on homegrown energy like coal and things like that. These are all problems. But it's like, just tell me if I'm right. You seem to be saying that the solutions that are being not just offered but demanded by, I mean, all sides, including the London media and the rest of the media around the Western world, are actually going to create a bigger crisis than they were supposed to solve.
Well, yeah, that's absolutely what's already happening, isn't it? I mean, if we were going to actually, I mean, the point of sustainable development, if you look at things like the Brundtland Report and stuff like that, the point of it is to ensure, you know, and improve the well-being of the poor. And to ensure that those that are that current generations are able to rise themselves to get out of poverty, the most vulnerable people. That's the point of sustainable development, whilst ensuring that that situation continues for future generations. That's what it says on the tin. That is what the you know, our common future kept banging on about. That's what they keep talking about at you know, places like Davos, where they talk about their inclusivity and leaving no one behind. It's all supposed to be about raising people's ability to live, you know, healthy and fulfilling lives, especially those people who are, you know, living in poverty at the moment. However, for example, if you just look at the German situations, the subsidy, because they're forcing through, and I'm not, let me put it in this sense. I don't think that renewable energy is a bad idea. I'm not arguing that renewable energy is a bad idea. It certainly could be part of the solution. For example, you could have micro power plants all around the world. If we decentralize power production and put micro power plants in places, you know, there are over a billion people that still use, you know, things like kerosene and wood to cook on.
Well, look, you know, I mean, one really, really obvious example from the UK is Gordon Brown's government had set up a system of very decent subsidies for ordinary people to put, including housing association tenants and council tenants, to put solar panels on their own roofs, which fed into their, supplemented their electric supply.
Yeah, so all of these kind of solutions would certainly help. If people had that, I mean, if we'd have continued with those subsidies for that and enabled people to do that, that would have been a good thing. There are so many things that we could actually do. For example, plant more trees. You know, that would be quite a good idea. There are so many things that we could do if addressing climate, you know, the said to be causes of climate change, and also genuinely following the principles of sustainable development, there are so many things that could be done that would move us towards, you know, a potentially a better world where people are more independent in terms of energy production, perhaps with local communities each having a micro power plant or something like that, which would subsidize energy production for everybody and would certainly go some way to addressing energy poverty and the resultant inequality that arises because of it, inequality of opportunity that arises because of it, then yeah, we could be doing this stuff. And I'm not against that. I think that would be a good idea. And as you quite rightly said earlier, You know, there are lots of environmental issues that we really need to get our heads around. You know, the pollution of the oceans, the plastics that we use, all this kind of stuff. You know, I am all for certainly that. But what we're doing instead, and what it, and this is, I would say, is classic accelerationism, is that we're focusing on one global issue. So if the issue is only CO2, if that is the only issue, we've only got one atmosphere. So for example, the UN's idea of sustainable development is one of the documents, it says, I can't remember which one, but one of the UN's documents says, it doesn't matter where we remove carbon from the atmosphere. So it makes sense to start with developing nations because, you know, if we basically, if we remove it from there, it's just as good removing it from developing nations because we've only got one atmosphere, blah, blah, blah. So what this is actually used for then is to stop developing nations accessing things like affordable energy, which is what they actually need in order to develop, you know, to the extent that the rest of the world has enjoyed that privilege. Similarly in Germany, you know, what's happened with the subsidies for their transition, the Energy Wende, their transition to sustainable development, is that it is massively pushed up the price of energy for the consumer, but not for wholesale purchasers. So multinational corporations and big industry that buy their energy wholesale, renewable energy has actually pushed down the price for them, but the subsidies don't come in until you get to the consumer end of the equation. And so it's pushed the price up for everybody else. So even people like the German federal auditors have written to the German government to say, look, you're pushing lower income households and small to medium sized enterprises out of business. You're pushing energy prices beyond their reach with these policies. Now that is the opposite of what sustainable development is supposed to be about. But that doesn't matter, and I think you know, you may well have a point about accelerationism being an underpinning ethos, because the point is to break apart the current economic model in order, I would suggest, to introduce a new one. And that is how it is being used. So instead of investing in, for example, micro power plants in places like Africa and India and places like that, investment is going into the smart grid. Well, all that does, that doesn't help people that currently can't access the grid get energy. They're not, that doesn't help them. All that does is give a greater degree of control over those of us that are currently on the grid, over how we use energy. And that is the point of these kind of things. So again, it is the antithesis, it's the opposite of what sustainable development is supposed to be about. But that is precisely the kind of thing that you would expect to happen if accelerationism was the driving ethos behind it, which is, you know, seemingly, and as you rightly say, it is seemingly everywhere.
It's a bit difficult for me, having known Nick, to be dispassionate about his role in this. But I mean, when you started digging into this, you know what he's. I mean, he seems to be a sort of. I mean, okay. So let's just take you through his career after he left school. I last spoke to him when he was one of the philosophy professors at Warwick University. He always had a big thing for Nietzsche. And of course, many philosophers, successful ones, do. And even if they're not, you know, obviously Nietzsche, you know, this end of philosophy is very anti-God. It's very pro-humanity. The idea is almost well, through Nietzsche, that man can become God, is God. And of course, this does link in this philosophy anyway with transhumanism. So Nick, then, when he was up at Warwick. He was kicked out of Warwick University. There were all sorts of rumours flying around, including some that he was just selling or feeding drugs to his philosophy students, including most importantly, I suppose, I knew he was always into speed, but the hallucinogenics we've just been hearing about from Harry, you know, Prince Harry, LSD particularly. He was very much into that at school as well. He was, you know, quite a young age, like 16, 17. And I heard from a mutual friend who knew him at Warwick, who is, without saying his name, he works up at Worcester University, teaching fine art. And he was saying that Nick was conjuring demons. In fact, the Guardian article about accelerationism talks about the idea of Nick living in Aleister Crowley's old house, you know, the Satanist.
Yeah.
So I'm just curious about Nick. When you first came to this, how central a figure is he in this whole philosophy? Because I know he loves to do these things where he's writing a whole manifesto, kind of, this is the future, this is what it's all about. And he was very driven, a very driven guy. I absolutely hesitate to criticize him as a person, because he was quite a kind of magnetic personality. He was also, he had a brilliant dark sense of humor, which is one of the reasons I like the guy. Even though he's a Nazi, you know, if he's cracking some, I mean, I thought they were good jokes. But I mean, he was very cynical about humanity. And there was something about that that appealed to me. But anyway, so how central do you think he is in this?
I think he, you know, I mean, I very much looked at that Guardian article that was about the what was going on at Warwick University. And I think the interesting thing that stuck out for me from the article, and I'm sorry, I've lost the reference here, was the kind of perception of the kind of... the think tank that he and, you know, a few others were leading, not think tank, think project, maybe is probably a better way of putting it.
It was called the Cybernetics Research Unit, and it was with people like Sadie Plant. The idea is, you know, we're going to explore and look at this whole idea of computers running the world, basically designing everything. And when I was friendly with Nick back in, I guess it would be about 1979, he was talking about the internet. You know, this is whatever, nearly 20 years before it really started kicking off, you know, so 15 years anyway. But I never heard anybody else mention the word internet. Nick was onto it.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, he's a really smart guy. Going back to that article, the concept that I got from that very much was that, you know, it was kind of dismissed at the time as kind of cyberpunk navel gazing. You know, it was having any kind of like meaningful impact. But again, I would, you know, go back to this idea that the people that are watching these ideas, I mean, you could say the very much the same about the technocracy movement in the 1930s, although obviously that was quite a big national movement in the US. But the idea itself faded from public consciousness. And this and what Nick Land was pursuing wasn't even in public consciousness, really. It was a very niche thing at Warwick University. But obviously, some people were paying a lot of attention to what he was doing and what he was saying, because it has been translated into, as as I think it's fair to say, you know, one of the things that we're discussing here is it can be seen everywhere. Its influence can be seen everywhere. Now, Land himself based his work, The Dark Enlightenment, on the work of a guy called Curtis Yarvin, who wrote under the pen name of Mencius Moldberg. So I struggle to find out much more about Curtis Yarvin.
Look, let me just tell you, from knowing Nick, it could easily just be him giving false names and, oh yeah, this guy said this. Nick was the sort of person. But anyway, look, what I'm trying to get to here is he seems to be pretty central in the philosophy, obviously not in the implementation of it. There's a whole mass of globalists that seem to be implementing it. But there was this kind of aspect of evil. I'm not saying he's evil, but he was definitely associated with this sort of demonic thing up in, well, at least allegedly associated with this demonic thing up in Rook, interested in Crowley. And if you look at what this Dark Enlightenment is about, it's not about helping humanity. It seems to be about dragging humanity down to a complete crisis, meltdown point, which, you know, I think it's fair to describe as evil.
Yeah, and I think, you know, there is an element of do as thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law in it. You know, it's about the extreme use of power. It's about those who are in power being in power because they deserve to be in power. And the reason that they deserve to be in power is because they are capable of exercising power. It doesn't go any further than that. You know, there's no moral component really of the Dark Enlightenment side of it, his Nick Land's interpretation of it. And so you're right. I mean, there are those aspects of it that are very dark, and well, hence the name, I guess. I mean, it's Land that gave it the name Dark Enlightenment, which is quite a kind of telling name to give something, isn't it?
Well, it says almost everything about it, doesn't it? The idea is, the idea is that this is being unfolded on society as a great solution, but actually it's going to kill you. You know, this is Nick all over, the Nick I remember. You know, it's a sort of, it's got a kind of anarcho-capitalist feel to it. In a nutshell, what do you think, what can we do to understand how this is working in our everyday lives?
Well, it is very much about the centralization of power and authority. That's what it's about. It's about, you know, that power should be exercised from a strategic central point, because that's the best way to exercise power. I mean, Land talks about that being moving towards some kind of nirvana where people don't have to worry about the little things. You know, like what they're going to eat, or you know, where they're going to go, or where they're going to work, because these decisions will be made for them. Now, Land is suggesting that would be a good thing, and that, you know, that there's no need for people would, in his vision, would be able to concentrate on other things. Like,
well, that's not a million miles away from the Marxist visions, is it, or communism?
Yeah. And I think when you look at either, you know, extremes of the left and right, they kind of wrap round on each other, don't they? I mean, you know, the Nazis were National Socialists. So, I mean, this kind of idea of power being exercised by those who are best suited to exercise power, leading towards a kind of utopian society where us, the little people, are free to indulge ourselves in intellectual pursuits and sports and things like that. I mean, that is a sort of recurring thing. I mean, you can go all the way back to kind of Plato for that, can't you? I mean, it's that is a kind of recurring theme. And yet, when we see that put into application around the world, whenever someone comes to a position of supreme power and authority, it generally doesn't really work out that well for the rest of us. You know,
it's a regularly reoccurring cover for dictators, for tyrants. You know, the best people should be in charge. Well, they're quite clearly not. I was just having a discussion with somebody today about this whole idea. Well, it seems that most of the people who have been put into power are just there because they're pliable individuals who can be just called up and told to think something, and they'll think it and they'll say it. It's also, I think, important to register that I have approached Nick by a couple of different methods to be interviewed, and at least to be, you know, part of some of the discussions about his work, but he hasn't got back to me in his, you know, cold way. He likes to be seen to be the cold guy, which is a pity, because it would be lovely to catch up after all these years. But, well, I mean, it doesn't seem like they're the best people for the job at all. In fact, they're possibly the worst.
Yeah, no, I think that, most personally, I feel that most government can be described as a kakistocracy. That's what we generally have. But then, I'm probably the wrong person to speak about that because I'm not a big fan of government, full stop. So, I mean, that wouldn't be, that's I would see things like that, wouldn't I? And I mean, one of the things that about writing this article is, I'm aware of my own kind of confirmation biases and stuff like that. But nonetheless, I found this. I mean, one thing I would recommend that everybody go, the links are all in the article. I would recommend that everybody go and read The Dark Enlightenment, but I have to say it is impenetrable. It is,
Well,
you know,
this is the trouble with Nick's stuff is, I find my eyes closing and my brain switching off after the second sentence.
Yeah, it's pretty impenetrable stuff, but there are, some there's just enough, and you said he has a good turn of phrase, and there are just enough things in it to prick your interest to keep you going, I think. And then you end up kind of going back, and I mean, I had to de this the irony is, in order to make sense of it, I had to deconstruct it and put it into some sort of order. Because when you read it, it isn't in any kind of order that you can make sense of. Now, to be fair to Nick Land, he's saying that he took it from this character Mencius Moldberg, who apparently was someone that Thiel invested in, this guy Curtis Yarvin. He had a startup P2P business which Thiel invested in. But anyway, I mean, one of the things that he came up was he spoke about what he thought as this idea about the Neo-Puritans, which he what we might call, I guess, the kind of modern progressive liberal. Some people might call them woke. Some people might use that term, but that kind of person that just goes along with whatever or follows the progressive mantra. Right, so there, the Dark Enlightenment was very much opposed to that. So he called these people the Neo-Puritans of the cathedral. So they're the neo of the cathedral, and he claimed that their beliefs were ultimately a fatal condition because they were going to lead the rest of us to total moral collapse. So one thing that he wrote, there's a little quote out of the Dark Enlightenment. And he put quote, postmodernity amounting essentially to a new dark age in which Malthusian limits brutally reimpose themselves. This scenario assumes that modernity 1.0 has so radically globalized its own morbidity that the entire future of the world collapses around it, as if the cathedral wins, that's what we have coming. So little things like that, you kind of think, oh, well, that's quite interesting because of what he calls the cathedral. The cathedral is the nexus between, in his view, the modern polity and corporate hegemony. But his solution to that is to get rid of the polity part and just have the corporate hegemony, because that would make sense. This is what I mean. It's just he comes up with these things. Oh, well, that's actually quite interesting. That is quite interesting. Is it self-defeating? Many people would argue that it is. I think it probably is. So I can agree with that, but I don't agree with him that the solution to that is therefore to give unbridled power to global corporations.
Yeah, well, it's interesting how this theme comes up again and again and again, doesn't it? And I think many of us sitting watching the 10 o'clock news or whatever raise our eyebrows in a similar fashion and think, well, is this really the best way to deal with this problem? Or is anything being done in any way to stop this when you're seeing something going wrong or whatever? It just seems like the solutions being proffered are always the wrong solutions, and I don't know. That almost seems to be pre-programmed in somehow. I mean, he also talks about this whole idea of GovCorp, which is obviously some kind of fascist system of big corporate conglomo I don't know if anyone's seen Rocco's Modern Life, where you've got that massive corporation that just owns everything. In fact, their slogan is "We own you." And the people are, their participation in this fascist superstate is as every individual is a shareholder in it. That's what he's, I mean, whether, you know, say, for example, you can be sanctioned or whatever and you lose your shares or, you know, but I mean, this is not a vision of anything even vaguely democratic or any kind of society that anybody that knew that this was being talked about or planned would want anything whatsoever to do with it.
No, absolutely not. But I would suggest that that has manifested itself on the global stage as stakeholder capitalism. That is stakeholder capitalism. So you see, this is what I mean about it being, these ideas being co-opted and adopted by, for example, you know, in this case, we're talking about Klaus Schwab. So, but that idea of stakeholder capitalism, that idea that global corporations should be, quote, the trustees of society, which is the basis of stakeholder capitalism. Well, that's what Land is talking about in the Dark Enlightenment. Now, and the interesting thing he said about shares, he said, yes, everything should be divided up in shares. So the cathedral, which is this, as we say, this nexus of these, of political power and corporate power, should be broken up into its constituent elements. And that should be, and then power within it should be subdivided to those that have already got power. I mean, this is the way that he works. But let's be real, you know. Let's not just give it to politicians because they don't really have any power. Let's give it to Pfizer. Let's give it to you know, the Bank for International Settlements. Let's give it to Deutsche Bank. They've already got power, so let's get real about this. Let's give them the power and let them get on with it. But the interesting thing he says about shares in terms of us, the working people of the world, is that our power is so meaninglessly trivial and meaningless that, yeah, we'll get some shares, but we'll have to divide it up amongst 7.8 billion people. So effectively, it's not worth worrying about.
Well, look, listen, man, he's not read The Lord of the Rings, has he? He's never heard of... Actually, you know what? He has read The Lord of the Rings because he borrowed it from me, aged 16. I got it back rather grubby with a few coffee stains on it. But anyway, you know, this is quite clearly a totalitarian agenda he's got here. Well, another aspect of all of this is we've got all these crises kind of coming down the tracks, slowly chugging towards us. We've got the enormous, basically NATO versus Russia war in Ukraine, which anything can happen there. There's all sorts of ways that could become much bigger. We've also got this crisis in the Middle East between Iran and, I mean, you know, there are quite a few. We've got the crisis of energy, where people are simply not going to be able to heat their homes, cook their food. We've got an economic crisis coming down the tracks, or which has already arrived, really, which is causing many key workers that keep our society civilized to be going to food banks. So as this crisis comes along, so the US, this is what interests me about all of this. Probably the most important of all of these is war. Because that's the last thing anybody wants. We can maybe, you know, beg or borrow or grow some food, but if there's a massive war, a lot of people are going to die, tens or even hundreds of millions of people. And so one of the fascinating things about all of this, I find, is looking at the way at which some of these World Economic Forum people, and including particularly the Biden family and others, have got a close link between China and the United States. So at one stage, you know, what we're seeing is the release of this man-made virus, I believe, anyway, over in China. There's a sort of attack on China by America, by the, you know, the Pentagon and these people. I mean, obviously people have got different interpretations. That's one interpretation of it. But at the same time, on another level, on the sort of what you might call a Kissinger level, or a Larry Fink level, you know, you've got enormous amounts of cooperation, or Hunter Biden level, you've got enormous amounts of cooperation too, Ian.
Yeah, I mean, I something else that I've written about quite extensively lately has been the so-called multipolar world order, which is supposedly on the table at the moment and is a, you know, has been suggested to us as a you know, as a potential. Some people seem to be supporting it as a potential solution to you know, the kind of problems that we might, you know, envisage with the World Economic Forum and so forth, and accelerationism, actually, you know, the collapse of everything. I agree, you know, there are way too many agreements and shared objectives for me to fully accept the antagonism that we are supposed to believe is prevalent at the moment. And it's a difficult thing to talk about because obviously there is a war. You know, there's no doubt that there's a war and that people are suffering terribly in Ukraine, and in the new, you know, Russian republics and oblasts. It's there's no doubt about that. And also, if you look at it from a historical perspective, you can see that there are very kind of, if ever there was a place where war had real antecedents, then you can see that that's, you know, Ukraine has got them. So I'm not suggesting for one moment that the conflict in Ukraine is in any way fake or you know, it's not like some kind of long-running false flag or anything like that. But it is being manipulated, and it in my view, and it follows the again on this theory of accelerationism. It is the epitome of accelerationism, because the breakdown in supply chains that happened as a result of the I very much would say it was a coerced and fake pandemic. The economic turmoil, the shutdown of industry, the shutdown of the economy, that began in earnest was it was an accelerationism of something that had been go an acceleration of something that had been going on for a long time, I would argue since 2008, and then it and then the you and then as soon as that comes to a conclusion, as immediately as that process not comes to a conclusion, because obviously there's still aspects of it that are ongoing, but in the West, as that starts to wind down, as the so-called pandemic winds down, we then go into a European war, which has exacerbated and, quote, accelerated those problems even further. We then, if you listen to the, I heard this afternoon Schwab's introductory speech at the World Economic Forum. He's talking about a fragmented world and the world being pulled apart by this you know, this coalition of various crises and so forth. It is Land could have written that speech. That Land could have written that. It is absolutely the epitome of accelerationism. The crisis is upon us. We must act now. There is no choice. In fact, at one point, I think Schwab said, you're either part, basically, I think, I can't remember his exact words, but it was something like, you know, there are those of us that are willing to work together to resolve these problems. You know, we are the solution. We must not allow anyone to stand against us, more or less. You know, if you're not basically, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. But the solution is the solution we define, and we also define the nature of the problem. So we define the nature of the problem and we define the solution. If you're not 100% on board with us, you're the enemy. Is more or less what he said in that introductory speech to this to Davos this week. And as I said, I mean, it could have been written by Land. It was well, pretty horrendous, really. I mean, the you know, the people don't figure in their ideas about where the global economy and the global power structures are going. We're not even in that equation.
Well, they may be incredibly deluded. They may be front men, you know, for something
Yes.
else. But at the end of the day, they're not going to get what they want. And it seems that's what this is all about. They're pushing and pushing for it. And they are just adding to the problem. You know, so even though they're saying, you know, we've got the solution, you've got to be with us, they are the problem. It's really, I mean, it's probably one of the most incredible bits of gaslighting ever in human history, really. But I mean, I'm just trying to drag you back to this business with of the US and China. I mean, I was looking at there was a fascinating story about US military satellites being used by the Chinese because they needed them for surveillance purposes in China, and the US cooperating with that. I always remember a fascinating talk by Anthony Sutton from the Hoover Institute, I think he was at, where he was explaining the way that during the Cold War, US technology was being quietly shipped over to the Soviet Union for them to use in various conflicts not in the Far East, but maybe it was in the Middle East. But, you know, making sure that we had this in the Second World War, didn't we, with the Rockefellers giving the rubber, synthetic rubber technology to the Nazis because... Yeah. The Nazis didn't have access to rubber supplies and this sort of thing, and of course a bit of oil too into the bargain at very high prices. But I mean, China, to me, it seems we've got quite a lot in common between the US and China, and there's a big faction in the US represented in a way by Hunter Biden and Joe Biden, who's now obviously president, seems to have a few problems with his leaving his confidential documents lying around. But I mean, you know, what amazes me, Ian, is, you know, there's no mention of Julian Assange in this story about Biden leaving this confidential stuff lying about. Or apparently it was in a locked garage. Yeah, okay, great.
Yeah, yeah.
But you know, Assange is being basically been put in the medieval dungeon for just doing his job as a journalist, whereas people who are actually breaking the Espionage Act over in the States are not. Anyway, look, getting back to the point. I think the Russians are not the Chinese, and there's a different kind of vibe in Russia, more of a, maybe you could look at it as a kind of Orthodox Church vibe rather than Chinese Communist Party atheistic vibe in China. And I mean, the best way I've seen this Ukraine thing described is by Michael Hudson, the economist, and I think his book was called I don't know if you can help me out here, but it was an absolutely fascinating book. It was called
I don't know.
The future. It's the future of civilization. I think it's the future of civilization. Finance capital. It's a great long, very long title, which is one of the reasons I find it really difficult to remember. The future of civilization, finance capitalism, industrial capitalism, or socialism, right? He's a socialist economist, and he's saying basically, if you've just got a mixed economy and a reasonably strong government that's actually managing that economy, you have no problem. It's when the finance people start controlling the politics, controlling the press, you know, controlling the planning, development, you know, building, trade, and once they get their tentacles into everything, you've lost it, basically. And this is what he says is going on in Ukraine, is that it's a pushback really against the finance capitalists who are just trying to use money to buy up absolutely everything. So what do you make of that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's something to, I mean, if you look at what people like Dugin, you know, the person that was wrongly called Putin's brain, which he'd never even met Putin, so that's kind of a silly thing. But I mean, but if you and look at the kind of Eurasianist kind of aspect in terms of what people like the economist, I've forgotten his name, Glazyev, and people like that are talking about it, I think there is an element of the kind of clash of civilizations belief possibly held in Russia in terms of seeing the world in very distinctly different terms from the kind of Western, simple Western corporate led model that has been foisted upon, you know, every other kind of quote unquote liberal democracy. You know, they see more of a kind of cultural difference there, and certainly, I mean, I think the Russians, you know, have quite clearly drawn a distinction between themselves and Europe and Eurasia in terms of, in terms of, you know, more the Asian continent, and certainly see themselves as a distinct people away from China. So, I mean, and I think that there is definitely an aspect of that, and I think there are certainly elements of it in which Russia are trying to assert a different model of, I would argue, the same thing. Because what is going to happen, in my view, is that we're going to have a global economic transformation. That I think that's inevitable. I mean, we're already seeing flows of capital change completely, with more capital flowing towards the east, goods, goods, energy, everything flowing towards the east. Now, China, obviously, even though recent, growth estimates have been downgraded due to a great extent to their response to COVID, China's growth, even though it's been downgraded, is still, two or three times the expected growth of anywhere else, and certainly anywhere in Europe, and even including the States. So its future and its current propensity and need for oil, gas, coal, all resources, metal, everything, all commodities, is pretty immense. At the same time, we've also heard, obviously, today that for the first time, China's population has gone down, and they certainly do have an age demographic problem, which is rapidly approaching. So I think everything's up in the air, but certainly when you see things like India quadrupling its oil purchases from Russia, as Russia had its the sanctions were imposed upon it. And you get weird anomalies like Gazprom still providing gas through Ukraine to Europe. I mean, during a war, a bloody conflict. I mean, you do have to wonder how these things happen. And certainly, you can look at the way that the Russians have fought the war. Seems odd. There are odd things about it. Not exploiting their technological supremacy to the extent, not exploiting their air power to the extent that they
Okay,
could
well,
have
just
done.
hang on, hang on, because Nick and I used to have a little club just off Hayes Common, where he lived, called the Diplomacy Club, and we would play war games and things, right? So this is how nerdy I was as a 14, 15-year-old. And yeah, so you keep your cards close to your chest, you know. They of course, the Russians want to keep stuff up their sleeve. They may be a bigger war around the corner. The air power business, well, you know, the air power is much more indiscriminate, and so the certainly my understanding of what's going on in Ukraine from so far away is that the civilian casualties are being kept deliberately by the Russians to a minimum. And I mean, obviously they're being maximized in the press over here, but they're going quite slowly. I mean, this is not a blitzkrieg.
No.
And so I would just say that's probably why why we're seeing those things coming from there.
Yeah, I can understand that, and I think that certainly seemed. I mean, I remember reading about the argument that when they first started the special military operation, they assumed they would be welcomed. There was a there would be a sizable part of the population would welcome them
Well, I think
rather than.
they are. If you watch RT, you'll see. I mean, when they take over a city, there seems to be a sort of, you know, some of the people in the city are really pleased that the Russians are there. I mean, obviously,
Yeah,
we
no,
don't see that on
absolutely.
our TV.
No, absolutely. And I think obviously the people in the Donbass probably very much welcome the Russian presence. And I think also, even though the campaigning in the referendums was very one-sided, I think there's no doubt that the people of those breakaway regions in Ukraine that wanted to cede to the Russian Federation. There's no, I, I'm not, I'm sure of that. And also, I think that, if we look at things like the problem that Ukraine has with Nazis is,
Oh.
it does have a significant Nazi
And let
problem.
me
So,
say as well, the London media has a taboo on this, which is just diabolical.
Yeah, I mean, there's, you know, I mean, it's got a significant Nazi problem, and arguably, I mean, well, not arguably, I mean, after the 2014 CIA orchestrated coup, which is what happened in 2014, you know, the Nazi element of that, that were, you know, I mean, I personally, I think the evidence suggests that they were overwhelmingly responsible for the deaths that occurred in the Maidan Square. I think they were shooting both sides. They were rewarded politically, you know, the, you know, they were, people like Androy Parabi were given disordinate amounts of political power, which they immediately converted into military power. Now, this is not to say, and this is where it gets very complicated, this is not to say in any way that the Ukrainian people are Nazis, right? I mean, I think that's the problem. If you start pointing out that Ukraine has a what you could call a Nazi problem, that is not the same as suggesting that the Ukrainian people elected Nazis. They didn't. The Ukrainian people, you know, in the last general election, certainly in the last presidential election, elected someone that they thought was going to reduce tensions and lead them towards, you know, a closer relationship, again, a closer relationship with Europe, more than NATO, but certainly perhaps NATO as well.
Well, yeah, I mean, Zelensky was actually elected on a platform of bringing peace to the breakaway regions in the southeast, and he did completely the opposite under threat of a gun to his head.
Exactly. And also being, you know, let's not forget that people threatened to hang him. You know, members of the right sector publicly declared in Ukraine that if Zelensky continued down this path, they would hang him from a tree. Now, can you imagine that being said in by anyone
Well,
in?
look, I mean, let's just be clear. These things were said at mass Nazi rallies in Ukraine,
Yeah.
with hundreds, if not thousands, of young people holding torches aloft in absolute imitation of what was going on in 1930s Nazi Germany.
Yeah, and you know, and Bandera is publicly venerated as a national hero. So, you know, there's no, what I'm trying to say is there's no doubt, and I've always said this, that the Russians have definitely got a point about, and obviously from a Russian perspective, having a country on your border with that kind of level of Nazi infiltration in it, you know, that for very good reasons, the Russians have got a pathological hatred of Nazis, which is, of course they have after what happened during the Second World War. So, you know, that's, although, you know, that being said, ironically, I mean, perhaps one of some of the most extreme Nazis in Ukraine, people like Wotan-Jungand, are Russians. But they have to go to Ukraine because they've been expelled from Russia. So, you know, there's that point. So the denazification thing was a pretty legitimate kind of casus belli, I guess you could say. And so was the idea of stopping NATO's eastward expansionism, and so was the idea of demilitarizing, you know, Ukraine and making it, you know, a peaceful neighbor, or trying to encourage it to be a peaceful neighbor. And let's not forget that, you know, the people that the Russians were defending had been in a war for 8 years. They'd been heavily shelled throughout that time. The whole thing started with two horrendous massacres, one in Odessa, and the other in Mariupol, of Russian speaking and ethnically Russian Ukrainians by Nazis. So, you know, there's every reason why Russia would get involved in that war if you look at it from that perspective. I mean, I would argue that so far it seems that effort has failed miserably. I you know, I see little evidence that, I mean, you see weird things like swapping Russian oligarchs for Azov style Nazis. I don't see how that helps when you're trying to denazify the country. You also see things like, odd things happening around, for example, the nuclear power plant, where it seems as if, potentially Russia took that very easily. Now, I mean, it's hard to say from sitting out in your armchair in the UK, not really knowing what's going on out there, relying
No,
on
you're right.
reports to sort of try and put all this together.
Well, this is what the journalists are supposed to do, of course. And we're getting two completely different points of view now. I mean, in fact, the whole this is another aspect to all of this. You've got the nuclear bomb has allowed the most incredible fear to spread around the world, the fear of being nuked. Plus, you've got the television, which is the propagandist's dream. I mean, if they'd have had, obviously, they had radio in World War II, and that was the main way people got to hear about stuff. And I was fascinated that William Joyce, Lord Haw-Haw, who was broadcasting from Radio Luxembourg during the war, a Nazi propaganda into Britain, there was a whole tussle over here about, well, should we can jam him, sir, to Churchill. No, Churchill didn't want him jammed. He ordered the BBC, well, told the BBC, look, feel free to take the mickey out of him, but we're not jamming him, because they knew that, people needed to hear both sides, and they would make their mind up, and they were absolutely confident that that the Nazi propaganda was going to fall flat, which it did. This is what bothers me about this time. It's like, we are the ones who've been shutting down the Iranian broadcasters, expelling Chinese ambassadors. I think the Chinese one you can still get, RT being banned. It's quite clear to me that you've got a world which is now divided into TV networks, Ian.
No, definitely. I mean, one of the, the decision to block, for example, Russian websites. I mean, it's, I mean, everybody knows how you get around them, but I mean, nonetheless,
Well, they
for
do
much.
everybody, but we, I mean, we, this is what we were having a go at 5 years ago, 4 years ago. We were having a go at the Chinese. Oh, what a bunch of authoritarian losers. What, look what they're doing. They're cutting off the internet for people. Now we're doing exactly the same.
Yes, but we're adopting everything from China. That, as you going back to what you were saying earlier about China. I mean, China's military is at the level that it is now. This is not to, again, this is not to detract from, Chinese ingenuity. Chinese are perfectly capable of great feats of ingenuity, and certainly, there is a rumor that China has now got, front-facing AI weapon systems, and it is, including things like ships and tanks and, so forth. So that is pretty, that would be a technological leap forward that it appears China may have taken. I mean, that's, whether that's confirmed yet or not, I don't know, but certainly people seem to be arguing that is the case. But if you look at China's military arsenal and the way that it has been able to get technology has come from the West. I mean, the West has been pumping foreign direct investment into China for decades. China's economic progress, and certainly its technological and economic progress, has been hugely supported by the West. The West has made, not made China, because that's not, that denies them agency, but has assisted China greatly in becoming the global power that it obviously now is. I mean, we got situations at the moment where Saudi Arabia, last I saw, Saudi Arabia have already taken some payment in the yuan for oil, but they don't massively buy it in the yuan, but it looks like they will do, that they're very close to doing that. Russia is taking oil, is selling, and has been for some time actually, but Russia is selling more and more oil, exchanging it for the yuan. Now, if Saudi Arabia do the same, then we're talking to looking at, a de facto petro yuan. And then you've got, at the same time, you've got things like the BRICS that are put in, that are suggesting a new basket of international currencies based on similar special the idea very much like the IMF special drawing rights. So we're looking at a global transfer of the international monetary and financial system, a complete transformation of it that is being enabled by, you have to say, Western sanctions in against Ukraine. Because when the US seized $630 billion worth of Russian gold and Russian rubles, and announced to the world basically that the US dollar was not a reserve currency that any other country in the world could rely upon. Now, why would they do that? But another question is, presumably knowing that this conflict was on the horizon, unless there's no communication between the Russian government and the central bank, why would the Russian central bank allow that possibility to remain? It's odd. From both sides, it looks strange. Now, what the effect of that is a complete transformation of the international monetary and financial system. Now, if we go back to what people like Carney at the time, who was governor of the Bank of England, when they were speaking at Jackson Hole in 2019 at the G7 Bankers Summit at Jackson Hole, Carney spoke about the need to transition to a new IMFS, International Monetary and Financial System, that was, I can't remember the precise quote, but that was suitable for a new multipolar world order. Now, in 2 years, in well, 3 years now, coming up for 4 years, everything has coalesced to enable that transition to take place. Now, I'm not saying that things like the Ukraine war are just orchestrated out of thin air, that, you know, these things can just be made to happen. But as we saw during the First World War, the Second World War, war can cert, you know, there are forces in the world that can maneuver the situation into a position where war is more likely than not. And I'm, you know, suggesting that is the case that we are seeing here. At the very least, what we are seeing is exploitation of that.
Well, definitely. I mean, if you look at the facts around the Russian invasion, it was quite clear the Russians had intelligence that the Ukrainian army, which was massed around the Donbass, was about to invade the Donbass region. I mean, there was already 15,000 people who had been killed by the indiscriminate shelling of the Donbass by the Ukrainian army. And then at the Munich Security Conference, Zelensky announced that he wants nuclear weapons. I mean, it seems to me, this is a deliberate provocation. In fact, if you go back 6 months from the invasion, you find all these bizarre announcements in the UK about how energy prices are going to go through the roof, and everyone's scratching their head. Well, what do you mean? What's going on? What's going to happen? And also, of course, the withdrawal from Afghanistan. And I think there were a few of us at the time thinking, so what's this about? You know, and this, it seems to me, is pretty good evidence that the whole thing was an orchestrated provocation. They knew the Russians would not be able to accept a Zelensky that was claiming that he was going to, you know, be scooting around the world trying to get nuclear weapons, that they weren't going to have this. But anyway, look, just to sort of try and wind up, Ian, I'd like to go back to Hayes in Kent, where Nick used to hop on the train to Eden Park Station to our school, and I would cycle from the other end of Hayes, actually, from near Pickhurst, around that area. And our things on a Saturday where we used to play diplomacy, it was called Diplomacy Club. There was quite a few of us. And I'm looking at a board, I'm imagining a board of diplomacy with this big, you know, three players with a big power on one side, which is the United States, a big power on the other side, which is China, looking to create World War III. Actually, they're secretly, because I don't know if you've ever played diplomacy, but you do quite a lot of chatting outside the room, you know, with other players. And so in the kitchen, making a cup of coffee, whispering in each other's ears, right, we're going to clobber the little guy. Actually, what we're going to, but what can happen in that situation? I'm thinking here about the three major superpowers, China, America and Russia, obviously NATO, really America, and obviously there are others associated, but looking at a clash between China and America, where actually the Russians could clear up, Ian. What's your crystal ball? Because, I mean, that's what we should be doing with all our knowledge, is trying to let people know where this may be going.
Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't necessarily count Europe out of that equation at the moment, because one thing that this does lend itself to as well is increased military unification in Europe, which they are very eager to do, and they are, you know, we see things from von der Leyen talking about the Sahel and how you know, that this is really an area for EU military intervention, not
well,
NATO.
I thought that von der Leyen and the European Commission just take their orders from the US, don't they?
I don't know who takes orders from who, really. I think that they all take orders from the Bank for International Settlements, personally. But you know,
the three power blocks. When I say NATO, I'm talking about Europe and North America, really. Actually, what I'm describing is more like a risk board, isn't it?
I hope that if full-blown war breaks out, a modern technological war, I don't think that's controllable. I think that could you couldn't sort of say, right, well, this might suit our purposes. I mean, taking the accelerationist line, that would precipitate the complete destruction of everything. But problem is, it really would precipitate the complete destruction of everything. Now, I think that there are people with vested interests that wouldn't want to see the total destruction of everything. I think they would like to see us fear the total destruction of everything and change our behaviour accordingly.
That's right. It's almost like a threat, isn't it? So yeah. It's sitting there. It's about to happen. Do as you're told, boys and girls. But then there is also, of course, this really quite frightening aspect for some people. Particularly, I mean, I remember looking at some of the figures around the Cuban Missile Crisis in the States, who seem to, you know, basically, well, if they don't believe in any kind of life after death, they maybe have kids, you know, they don't really seem to care much about, and they believe that death is the end of it. And so what's the, you know, there is no point in actually seeing the human race continue if they can be part of its downfall. They don't care. Effectively, they actually get a kick out of just exercising power for its own sake, like a drug.
Who was that? Who? What, during the Cuban Missile Crisis? What, the?
Well, yeah, there were a couple of characters. There was Curtis Lee May and General Power, who both were doing everything they could to kick off a Third World War in Cuba, because they saw, you know, we had this thing at the time in the 60s called the missile gap, where the Russians were accumulating enriched uranium and plutonium at far faster rate than the Americans. And in fact, that was one of the things that I was hearing earlier on today about, that was probably responsible for the Windscale fire, because the Brits had been told to produce more plutonium by the Americans. But so they saw the Russians catching up with the US nuclear stockpile, and they said, we've got to have a war now, otherwise they're going to overtake us. Let's get the war going right now.
Well, I guess people. Yeah. Sorry. I mean, I guess people have to hope that that there aren't voices like some voices. I mean, we might point to people like Dugin and so forth in Russia who don't think the same. Because currently, if we are to believe what we're told, it's Russia, China, India. They have the hypersonic advantage.
No, they do. Yeah, I think they do. I think they're prepared to use it. They're prepared to use that technology that they've been quietly, because this is the interesting thing about Putin, the way I see him anyway. And, you know, it'd be great to hear your view. Is he was playing these games with the World Economic Forum, you know, young global leader, G8, all this stuff. Meanwhile, quietly behind his back, he's preparing the most powerful, you know, arsenal ever known to defend his country from people he believes are maniacs. And he may have been right, you know. But, yeah, that's so, yeah, what Maybe we could just round off by, because I do like this idea of identifying the Russians as an interesting, you know, almost like the people will hate me for saying this, I'm sure, like the pepper in the soup, you know, everything would be all stitched up, as you were saying, if it was just China and NATO, but it isn't, you know, it's the Russians are something a little bit like the Chinese, they pretend the Chinese are inscrutable. We don't quite know which way they're going.
Yeah, I mean, I think the Chinese, clearly Russia and China have been building much closer economic and, you know, financial ties through, you know, think organizations like ASEAN and BRICS and so forth, and Shanghai Cooperation and so on. So they've got a growing economic interdependence. Russia's got the resources and got the natural resources that China needs. China is, you know, looking for markets. They're collaborating extensively on things like the Belt and Road Initiative. The Arctic Silk Road is massive. If that is constructed as envisaged, I mean, that could, you know, significantly reduce the global significance of, in from their perspective, the global significance of the Middle East. So who knows? one thing I would say is it's certainly, I mean, you know, and it's, and I don't want to come out like some sort of like I'm completely disinterested, because the last thing I want to see is human beings suffer, really. I despise it. But, you know, it's certainly an interesting time to be looking at the world geopolitically and, you know, in terms of where international relations are going to go. Personally, I think that there is a desire globally to transfer the economic model of usury and debt to new markets, and I think that there is a desire to build those new markets, and I think we're seeing in the emerging and developing markets that play out. And you know, I think Russia has probably got wind of that, rightly so, and for my money wants to be part, to protect its own interests, of course, but also to be part of that. You know, if you look at things like sustainable development, central bank digital currency, digital ID, all the worst aspects of the forthcoming sort of kind of technocratic globalist state that nobody wants, you know, Russia are leading on a lot of that stuff. So, you know, I wouldn't suggest that if Russia have a greater hand to play, that would be necessarily good for the world.
No.
Any more than if, you know, the US actually managed to completely dominate the globe. Personally, for me, the idea that any nation state or organization of nation states, even if it's something like the United Nations, which obviously China and Russia are very keen to advocate global governance through the United Nations, that is never going to be for the benefit of humanity, in my view, while there are people around the world who seek power for power's sake. And unfortunately, you know, that's our history. I mean, we, for 2,500, 3,000, well, more than that, 5,000 years, we have been subject to people who seek power for power's sake, and they are the holders of power. Which, going full circle back to Land's argument, is Land's argument is essentially, well, okay, gloves up, let them take the gloves off then, see what happens.
There's something quite anarchic. I mean, I've heard some people describe him as a kind of anarcho-capitalist. But anyway, look, we've done quite a lot of picking things apart, trying to put the world to rights, Ian. But at the end of the day, it's not talk that counts, but action. So let me just ask you to wind up by saying, you know, what people can, you think people can do about all this?
I think we have to focus on each other. We have to focus on our communities. We have to focus on looking after ourselves, looking after our families, being as independent as possible, and taking an active role in the decisions that we make every day. It does matter what we buy. It does matter what we spend our money on. It does matter how we spend our money. We have to think about decentralizing power, and we, because everything that whatever we look at, whenever we look at what is happening in the world, it is always about the centralization of power and authority. So the obvious solution to that is that we need to decentralize it, and we can do that by looking to each other and being more supportive of each other, thinking about things like counter economics, doing things for ourselves more, and relying on government less.
Yep, and corporations. And also, I mean, you're talking about spending. Use cash, folks. Yep. Anyway, Ian, could you just let people know whereabouts they can find your work? Maybe say something about UK Column, which is one of the places you publish on.
Yeah, my work, you can find me at my website, which is iandavis.com, and it's Ian with two I's, so it's iaindavis.com. I'm very
and
fortunate.
And just to say, it's Davis, not ES, so yeah. iaindavis.com.
Yeah, davis.com, yeah. And also, I write for UK Column, which is at ukcolumn.org. I'm also published by Off Guardian, which is off, all one word, offguardian.org, I think. And I write for Whitney Webb's Unlimited Hangout. You can find some of my latest pieces at Unlimited Hangout. And I'm also fortunate to be published by a number of other outlets, so you might find some of my work at other places as well. My last book was Pseudo Pandemic, is freely available on my website to my subscribers, and you can buy a hard copy if you wish through my website as well.
Okay, Ian Davis, thanks ever so much for joining us.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.